Good afternoon. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU FM. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland. We explore topics such as restorative justice, restorative practices, decolonization, cultural revival, and more. Our guests are people involved in aspects of truth, healing, and change work. This program is offered in an effort to share, inspire, and inform. Dawnland Signals is a collaboration of Wabanaki Reach and WERU FM. I am your co-host, Nick Bear.
Edgy Willy Giscock, Yedbem Giscock. It is a very nice day today, and I am your other co-host, Nolan Altvader. A lot of my relatives and friends lately have been telling me that they can really start to feel spring in the air, and I know I am also looking forward to embracing the change that the approaching season brings. And as we welcome these forthcoming changes of the season, I'm also excited to talk about the topic of truth-seeking in telling within the Wabanaki communities, as these initiatives are the first steps towards creating changes with and for our communities. On our show today, we have the privilege of sitting down with Penobscot citizen and former director of Wabanaki Reach, Maria Gerard, and Kat Stefko, who is the director of archives and special collections at the Bowdoin College Library, to talk about Wabanaki Reach's most recent truth-seeking initiative titled Beyond the Claims, Stories from the Land and the Heart. Now, for some background context, Beyond the Claims was an initiative that interviewed folks from Wabanaki and Maine communities in deep conversations about the impacts of the 1980s Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act, culminating into a collection of oral histories and an original community-devised play and a photography exhibit with an accompanying book. Beyond the Claims seeks to help demystify the legislation of the land claims, humanize those who have been affected by it, amplify their voices, and preserve their stories for cultural continuity. All of these iterations of the project will be available at the Bowdoin Library, continuing Reach's relationship with the institution from our previous truth-seeking initiative that established and guided the process of the historic Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In our conversations today, we will not only explore deeply into the Beyond the Claims initiative, but also consider how the relationship between institutions and Indigenous communities can result in benefits for Indigenous peoples and the protection of our cultural and intellectual properties. However, before we begin today, I'd like to invite my brother Nick to offer our listening with an appreciation of the land.
Well, you and Nolan, before we welcome our special guests, we first want to start with appreciating the land. We recognize the strong Wabanaki women who introduced our communities to their perspectives and voices with this show. It is our duty to honor them as best we can with the reignition of this work. We are proud of where our seeds were planted. These roots connect us to our past relations and their knowledge systems. We are a support for all of our people. We have a responsibility to the communities we come from to provide spaces where all voices can be heard and embraced. It is an honor to be a part of this kind of work, and I am humbled by the opportunity to connect with my Wabanaki relatives in a new way that only could have been in my ancestors' wildest dreams. K'chi-Wiliwun Ndal Bemwak.
Ndolna Bemwak, Wiliwun Nick. Now, I'd like to start off with having our guests introduce themselves as they see fit and talk a little bit about their responsibilities in the Beyond the Claims project. Maria, do you mind starting us off?
I'd love to start off, but first I just wanted to say K'chi-Wiliwuni for the invitation to come onto your show and to engage in this conversation. I always say it's my favorite topic of conversation, the Maine Indian Land Claims. So I'm really happy. And my name is Maria Gerard Banawapskewi. I come from the Penobscot tribe, and I grew up on Indian Island with my grandparents during the formative years of the Maine Indian Land Claims, which is the basis for the Beyond the Claims project. I'm a tribal historian, and for as long as I could remember, I've always been interested and infatuated with history and place names and people who came before me. And so I pursued history as a course of study when I went to university, and I received my bachelor's and master's in history. And in choosing and trying to decide a topic for my master's thesis, I wanted it to be something that would be valuable to Scott people, and so I was drawn towards the land claim. I first started working for Wabanaki Reach, I think it was 2012, as a Wabanaki community organizer, as we were preparing our tribal communities for the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They were going to be coming into our community and hearing some very intimate stories, and we were preparing our community for that work. And during the course of the TRC work, during the testimony phase, when the commissioners would come into the tribal communities to hear stories, I heard several people say that we could really use a truth telling around the land claims. And my ears perked right up because that I was just finishing up my studies at the university around the land claims. And so I held on to that for a long time, and it would come up from time to time. But I think we really started giving birth to the Beyond the Claims project around 2020 in relationship to the legislation that was happening, or not happening, I should say, in the state of Maine. So I'll save a little bit for later around that, but just to say that my work with the TRC melded right into Beyond the Claims. And even though the seeds were planted and we held on to it for a long time, it took us a few years to really bring that to life. And I think it was t 2020 when we said, okay, yeah, we need to do something because we were failing in the legislature. And I was thinking, well, maybe the way to bring about changes, much needed changes to the land claims, doesn't rest in the legislature. Maybe it's with people, and maybe it's with changing how we have conversations about the land claims. Like, does it always have to be legalese, and does it always have to be at the state house? Like, my intent was to move the conversation from the head and all this legalese to the heart as people, and how Wabanaki people, Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, who were mainly involved in the land claims, how they were impacted throughout those years.
Kat, would you like to give your introduction now, please?
Sure, thank you. Gosh, Maria, that you're a tough act to follow, because not only does that help situate this conversation, but also the project in a really meaningful way. So thank you for that. So I'm Kat Stefko. I'm currently serving as interim director of the Bowdoin College Library, but for the past 10 years, I've been the director of Special Collections and Archives at Bowdoin College. And it's been among the most important aspects of my work to help facilitate access to the TRC Truth and Reconciliation Commission archives, which arrived at Bowdoin shortly before I did in 2015. I think we're all familiar with that project, and I know we're going to talk a little bit more about that project. That Truth and Reconciliation Commission work really focused on the child welfare system, and there were so many more stories to tell. And I know that Wabanaki Reach has thought very seriously and critically about next projects, including the land claims. And so I was really, really grateful when Wabanaki Reach contacted us with the idea that perhaps Bowdoin would be willing to play a part in making the new oral histories available about the land claim, those new oral histories available through our digital collections. So that is my role. I have to say I'm one of the I didn't grow up in Maine. I was actually probably about 8 or 9 years old when the claims settlement happened. I was in Ohio at the time. And for all intents and purposes, being that removed from it, it seemed like an amazing victory and celebration. And so it really was much later, through exposure to archival resources and research, through Maria's writings, and her thesis in particular, and then through this project that I began to really start to comprehend, I will say, the complexities of the lived experience around that. So I'm incredibly grateful that Bowdoin can help bring that knowledge and those stories to more people. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. You actually answered one of our questions. We were curious of sort of your exposure to it as the process was unfolding. So thank you for sharing that. And before we go deeper into our conversations, I actually kind of want to backtrack a little bit. And I know this could take up the whole conversation with between us together today, but Maria, do you mind just offering our listeners sort of a brief overview of the land claims? And the ins and out of it from that perspective, both from legally, but also within the community as well.
Sure. So it's really hard to define a place to begin when we start talking about land claims history, because even though it sort of came out in the 1960s, sort of with this radical backdrop that was happening across the United States, it had always been well known in our tribal communities about the loss of land that happened, since statehood, even prior to statehood. The loss of land and all that came with it, with the loss of land came the loss of, being able to take care of ourselves. The loss of language actually is associated with the loss of land and so much more. And so this has always been knowledge in our tribal communities. And then I always think that the radical backdrop of the 1960s played an important catalyst in bringing this forward. And it's really about the loss of land and the restoration of that land back and what it all means. When we're talking about land, we're not just talking about acreage and real estate. We're talking about our homelands that had supported us and maintained us and that we, have grown connections with, we've built relationships with over countless generations. And so it was so much more than just acreage, It really started to take formation in the 1960s. I credit the women of Indian Township for really raising it to the forefront and what had happened back in the 1960s. So the story goes, there was like the rediscovery of these old treaties that specifically outlined land holdings for the tribes and that they didn't have anymore. They were living on just a small fraction of what they felt that they were entitled to, let alone the fact that they lost, so much of their homelands. But and so there was four Passamaquoddy women who really, stood their ground, and I want to name them. It's Phyllis Sabattis and Delia Mitchell, Pauline Stevens, and Rita Renko. And as the story around the land claims goes, is that a deed was lost during a poker game, and that a non-native, a white man that was living and building his business alongside Passamaquoddy people in Indian Township, he won this deed. He started going about to make all these changes on the land, bulldozing and this and that. And these women stood up and said, no more. And so the land claims history kind of comes off from that. The women were eventually arrested for, I think they called it disorderly conduct. And then in the process of searching for legal representation for that incident and for those women, the Passamaquoddy Indian Township wanted to expand. They wanted to know, well, what happened to all of this land that was supposed to be ours, let alone this little plot that was lost in the poker game? And so that was like the birth of this modern land claims. And there was just so many unprecedented and crazy maneuvers that happened over time, and it really spanned the years of the 60s and into the 70s when it was, actually negotiated a settlement in 1980. So there was this whole time frame where there was just like pure craziness going on in the state of Maine. Like, this was unprecedented to think, like, these little tiny tribes that most people didn't even know existed anymore. And now they're saying, you know what? Two-thirds of the state of Maine is still ours. The basis for the land claims, once they got into seeking the legal representation, was that they went back on a 1794 congressional law that said that any land transactions that had to do with tribes or tribal members, it had to be ratified by Congress, because prior to that, there were all these land grabs going on and different people thinking they owned different plots of lands, and everyone, there was so much confusion going on as settlers were grabbing the land. So Congress said, you know what? Every time there's a land transaction, we need to ratify it. We need to know. And so it was somewhat thought of as a way to protect the tribes from, all this overtaking, but it didn't work. And so, in the process of the land claims, the legal representation under Thomas Tureen discovered that all of the land transactions that had happened since the state of Maine became a state in 1820, none of them had been ratified by Congress, and so they were all null and void. That was the basis of the land claims. So, as you can imagine, people were in an uproar around here. And the attitude was like, how dare they bite the hand that feeds them? Because for so many years, the tribes were seen almost like in a welfare state, But what most people didn't realize is that, yeah, the tribes were getting money given to them from state coffers, but that was from the sale of our own land that the state had taken and then put the funds into their coffers. And so they did regulate the tribes very much in that way. So just unprecedented history. During the time when the Passamaquoddy and the Penobscots were staking their claim to two-thirds of the state of Maine, it didn't go over well. There was so much overt racism. There was so many letters to the editors, and the newspapers really played it up. There was a lot of fear mongering in the headlines and stuff, and so there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of open racism. The Ku Klux Klan reignited up in just 10 miles north of Indian Island, up in Enfield, Lincoln area. And so it was really scary times. For me personally, I was very, very young as this was happening. And the changes that I experienced in my community directly were more about the expansion of our tribal community. So it was really about the tribes getting out from under the state government, under the thumb of state government, and becoming federally recognized tribes. And so that was like an aspect of the land claims that had to happen. And once we were able to gain our federal recognition as a result of our land claims fight, we started seeing all these things happen in our tribal community. We started seeing the expansion of our infrastructure. We started seeing a new bridge. We started seeing new housing. Our clinic was built, our fire department was built. And some of the old timers would call this like our golden age, because finally we weren't under the state government. We were a federally recognized tribe. And so those were the types of changes that I saw myself, and also the expansion of people coming into our communities. And so our tribal communities over doubled, with our census. Yeah, it was really quite a time for us. And I have a lot of fond memories of the time before the land claims, and remembering as it was occurring, and the housing, even, like, it was so fancy, we called it Hollywood. So there was a lot of good things that were happening as a result.
Will you one for that, Maria? Just want to remind the listeners, you are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU FM. I am your co-host, Nick Bear, along with my good NEDUB co-host, Nolan Altivater. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Today, we are talking with Penobscot Nation citizen and the former director of Wabanaki Reach, Maria Gerard, along with archivist Kat Stefko from the Bowdoin Library about Wabanaki Reach's Beyond the Claims Truth Seeking Initiative and the forthcoming opening of the project's archives.
And I'd like to kind of focus on the process, both the process of Beyond the Claims, but also the process of archiving not only this information, but recognizing that Bowdoin is continuing its relationship with Wabanaki Reach from its first truth-seeking initiative with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And Kat, I was wondering if you could share some insights of what that process looked like of coming into this relationship with Reach around these materials.
So, as I mentioned, the college had just entered into an agreement to accept and make available the TRC archives shortly before my arrival. And that was a collection that had been generated through many, many different creators, certainly TRC. Certainly, Wabanaki Reach had a part. There was also the commission itself, and then all of the contributors of the statements. With any oral history, rights and permissions are incredibly complicated. And I would say something like the TRC statements that are really about, well, genocide as defined in the final report. Are especially complicated in terms of balancing access, privacy, and supporting both the statement givers and those who will be using the collection. And frankly, we would not, I mean, we were in no way positioned to do this alone. It only made sense in terms of moving forward in a partnership environment with TRC Reach, or excuse me, with Wabanaki Reach. And it's been, that has been sort of the through line here, both in terms of how we went about making that first collection available, how it's presented online, having preparatory materials available through Wabanaki Reach, including a statement of support for those who want to interact and engage with the materials and really think about how to prepare yourself for what is, no matter your background, whether or not you're coming from the Wabanaki community or a non-Wabanaki community, whether you're an advanced scholar doing, in-depth research, or if it's your first exposure to the topics covered in the TRC's report and oral histories, it's hard, it's heavy stuff. It's really heavy stuff. And so we're incredibly grateful for the partnership and guidance that we've had with Wabanaki Reach to make that collection available and meaningful. I think we've learned a lot from that experience. And so when, and here's one way this played out. Like, so when we were approached in, I think it was 2024, with the idea of becoming a place to, I hate the word institutional home because it's actually, we're not the institutional home. We are a partner in making this available. So typically, when we're approached to take a collection or make a collection available, we work out a deed of gift, which would transfer ownership of a collection. And knowing what we knew about the TRC, the way that we've continued to interact and rely on each other as partners, we didn't want that. So instead, we signed a memorandum of understanding between Bowdoin and Wabanaki Reach. We do not own this collection. We will not own the collection. And that's a really important distinction here. We are entering in a formal partnership to provide for access and preservation of this collection. And I think that's incredibly meaningful, especially when you're talking about land claims, which the as Maria covered, so much of this is about deeds and misdeeds, frankly, misconstruing deeds and agreements over time. And we simply didn't want that as a defining parameter for this relationship. So it's a memorandum of understanding, and we are partnering in every spot and every aspect of having the collection come to us, how the collection's going to be described, making sure that people are comfortable at Wabanaki Reach with how the collection will be available online, and helping us mediate concerns that might come up, because we know that from our experience with TRC, people who gave testimony and signed off, gave permission to make those available. It's one thing to sign something, it's another to live with your statement online. And so we really want to have open dialogue with statement providers. And we rely on Wabanaki Reach to facilitate that. Is that helpful? Did I get at your question, Nolan?
Yes, very much so. I
Great.
love thinking of like these MOUs as like a new approach to treaty making with each other and actually doing it in a good way. So thank you for sharing that
Yeah,
information.
me too, honestly. I've been in this field like 30 years, and it's the first time where it's like, no, we don't want a deed. That doesn't actually articulate anything we want to accomplish with this. So for us, it was a first opportunity to develop an MOU, and it's a model that we want to keep in the forefront as we move forward.
Yeah, and that's so important given, the history of similarly with land loss, our culture and stories and tangible cultural heritage has been also dispossessed from institutions and put into that framework of ownership. So yeah, those MOUs and relationships with each other are very important to have as the basis starting off. So thank you for sharing some of that insight. And Maria's kind of similarly thinking through process. And I'd like to focus on the Beyond the Claims process, but I also want to welcome like what experience with the TRC helped you shape your approach to Beyond the Claims, and the process that you did for collecting these stories in the community, if you don't mind sharing about that.
The TRC did help us to shape the Beyond the Claims process a bit, in that we didn't want to be quite so formal with collecting testimony. So the TRC was, we call it like 3 years of the commissioner's research and gathering testimony. And so Beyond the Claims was purposely shaped more as oral history, as storytelling, and that everyone has a story to tell. And so that was a little bit of a hang up that we had early in the process when we wanted to collect the stories, as a lot of people said, oh, I don't know about the land claims. Go ask so and so. They know. And we had to convince people that if you were alive during the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, as the land claims was being carried out, you have your own story. Like, what do you remember? Even if it's about how we gathered wrinkles or how people skated on the ice or any of those things. And so we really started thinking about the relationship of people with the land that then became the topic of the legal land claims. So the process also included training some of our own folks in how to gather oral histories. And so we offered trainings to people who were interested in doing that type of work. And we consulted with an oral historian to help us with that. And just trying to make it as comfortable as possible for people. Like I said, a lot of people would think they didn't have a story to tell until we kind of got them warmed up and talking. And so all of the stories that people shared about what life was like in the 60s or in the 70s on our reservations. You know, to me, that is like a real treasure trove. It is so different now that at some point in time, you know, scholars or whomever researchers are going to look back and they're going to want to know what was the old Indian Island like, what was the old Pleasant Point like, or the old Indian Township like. And these stories will definitely give, you know, a glimpse into that. And so, yeah, we hired, you know, our own people. We gave them the training. We sent them out to do stories in people's homes to collect those stories. People were given the chance to review what they said. So, the stories that they told us were typed up and sent back to them for them to review. And if there's any changes, like, oh, I didn't mean to say that, or I probably shouldn't say this. You know, we gave them the opportunity to make changes before it became the story that would then go into the archives. And we wanted it to be more aligned to our way of sharing stories. And so when we look back at the TRC, we see that, you know, the process of commissioners coming into your community and hearing your story, given a testimony for research, that felt very different than people from your communities. Or And not everyone necessarily that collected the stories were from the tribal communities, but people coming into your homes and just spending time with you to hear your stories. That was very different than gathering testimony.
Thank you for that answer, Maria. Could you expand a little bit about what they did with all those stories after? The people that came into the homes that had these conversations with the ones who were giving not testimony, but sharing their stories. What happened with those after that?
There were three tangibles that we had envisioned coming out of Beyond the Claims. And one of them was to create a play. We realized that we wanted to teach people about this time period, but that not everyone learned in the same way. Not everyone was going to read a book or an article or listen to an interview or whatever. But if we could make a play about that would engage like a whole different audience into learning about the land claims in that time period. And so we did the play. It was the first tangible that we produced, and it was called Where the River Widens. And we performed that on Indian Island in when did we perform that on Indian Island? It was 3 years ago, I
23.
believe now.
Yeah, it was 2023.
With Kate Russell, who was our project coordinator, and she was so masterful with theater. It was so much fun. We created an original play, and we performed that for our tribal community based on stories that we gathered during this project. And then the next project that we did was the photography exhibit at Pleasant Point. And so, as part of this project, we were engaging very excellent tribal photographers, Nolan Ultivator and Meyer Atien, to sort of match some of these stories to some of the locations in our tribal communities, and to give a visual to the stories that were being shared. And so we had a wonderful exhibit at the Pleasant Point Museum in I think it was January of 2024. And then the final tangible product that we produced from these stories is the book by the same name, Beyond the Claims. And Kate Russell actually came up with the name of, because we kept saying the next truth telling project, the next truth telling project. We're like, we need a name, you know, we keep calling it. And so Beyond the Claims, Stories from the Land and the Heart, really captured what we were intending to do. And that was to get that story of that important history for our tribal communities, you know, coming from people's hearts and what it meant to them.
Yeah, that's beautiful, that name for the initiative. I just feel like speaks to the process like really powerfully from getting away from all of the mystification in the legislative perspective and really bringing it home to the Wabanaki communities and how it impacted us. And I'm curious, thinking of, taking all of those stories and putting them into an archive at Bowdoin in CAT, I'm wondering if you could share a little bit what these archives consist of within your institution there.
Sure. I have to working with Wabanaki Reach is pretty it's pretty dreamy. So I want to just say that to start. And this goes back to the TRC project as well. Maria talked a little bit about this, the process that the story collectors go through to work with the statement providers to make sure that they feel that their words have been accurately captured, recognizing the level of anonymity or not that the statement provider wants to. Wants is comfortable with, and really working with them to make sure that they understand the intent of making their statements available. That is really hard work, and Reach does it so well. They're highly organized, so thoughtful, conscientious, and making sure to close the loop. For all participants. And that makes honestly the work of the archives so much easier. It's often the case that we would receive an oral history. There may or may not be release forms. It may or may not be clear that these were meant to be made available to the public. And that feels like a violation, right? It's a violation of trust, it's a violation of privacy. It's just it makes it hard, and it while a collection may have wonderful historical value, it gives us great pause, and it's a lot of work from a forensic point of view to track down folks and make sure we have permissions to make something available. So I just want to give a huge thanks to I know Kate Russell was the project manager, but there were so many other people that contributed to making sure that the collection came to us very well intact in terms of the statements, transcripts, and permission forms. So we will make the transcripts and the audio available online. There's a platform that we have for our digital collections that will become part of. And because there are transcripts, it will allow for researchers to do searching to discover statements from across collections, including beyond the claims. So that's incredibly helpful. But with that said, the primary way that constituents here at Bowdoin interacts with our collections are through instructional sessions that we offer. So in my department, we have somebody who's the education and engagement librarian, and we also have a research and instruction librarian. We're working with undergrads, and most of them don't understand the main Indian land claims, the Settlement Act or its implications. This topic is so complicated. And so I am incredibly grateful that we now have a collection that we can point students to that offer a humanized, demystified look at what that Claims Settlement Act actually means and its implications. So we're going to be taking advantage of the book as a way of introducing people. That includes some of Maria's thesis in, by way of an introduction that helps lay the groundwork, because to make meaning of this collection, it really is helpful to have those other preparatory contextual materials. And so we're really grateful that it's not just the oral histories, but it's all this the components of the project that are coming and that we can work with.
Thank you, Kat. I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU FM. I am your co-host, Nick Bear, along with my brother, Nolan Altivator. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change.
Our guys are powerful. I mean, thinking about the origins of the main Indian land claims and Maria's note about the, somebody finding a deed, it does point to the importance of keeping written records. And so we're happy to play a part in preserving that history.
When it comes to truth in its relationship to archives and recognizing that Wabanaki people and indigenous people everywhere have always had a system for collecting information as well. We have our own archives, whether it's our petroglyphs or our visual art or whatever it may be. And now that's how I view like the work Reach did with the Beyond the Claims. It's like continuing that project of having our own systems of memory and archives and our own forms of truth and healing. And when it comes to that information within these stories, you know, specifically thinking of all of the difficult history and truth that surrounds the treatment of Wabanaki children within Maine's child welfare system, but also all of the tensions that the land claim settlement process brought to the community that both are very palpable and tangible today. Could either of you speak more to, you mentioned having sort of this framework to prepare people to engage with these archives. Could you give a little bit more detail about what that preparation may look like or looks like for folks?
I can start, and Maria should feel free to jump in here as well. But I would, if I may, I would point out that on Wabanaki Reach's website, you have a wonderful blog, Voices of Decolonization, and Marika van de Steenhoven, who is my education and engagement archivist librarian here at Bowdoin, actually provided a piece for that back in 2022. And it's such a really powerful piece. And it talks about the process that she has working with faculty to get students ready to work with the TRC. And one of the points that she makes in that, well, certainly the need to partner with faculty to make sure we understand what their learning goals are, like what's the primary reasons we want students to interact with these materials, and what do they hope we hope that students will take away from that experience. And one of the things that Marika has realized in terms of working with this TRC in particular over the years is that given the limited time we have to interact with students, focusing on helping those students understand the TRC and the process of it is really important. And so the classroom session itself involves exposing students to the incorporation documents, the timeline and research that the commission and Reach developed to support the project. Guidelines for statement providers. And so the sort of the structure that went around the statements so that they understand the process that led to the statements being available and thus to prepare them to really interact with the statements in a meaningful way. I think without that, our fear is that the topic is so hard. The statements can be really challenging. And I think for students who are new to it, there's a fear that they might shut down emotionally. And so helping lay the groundwork and make sure that they're ready to interact with materials is one of the primary goals of the class session. I think it's harder to replicate that with online researchers. And frankly, I do worry about especially, exposure through like a Google search or totally unmediated experience coming upon a statement. And we don't have a perfect solution for that at all. We do try to make sure that there's material metadata around a statement and links back to Reach. But there's, I think, more work we can and should do to make sure that our online researchers are getting the same level of support. And that's a conversation that we've had with Reach over the years and that we're going to continue to have. Technology keeps getting better, and so we just implemented a new system, and I think an underlying system to make all of our digital collections available. So this is another time to revisit that. But I think having human touch and human interaction, mediation is really, really important. And so we try to provide that whenever and however we can.
I wanted to add just the importance of gathering the information all in one place. I have been a historian for like 4 decades now. I can't believe I'm like looking at my life's work in terms of decades now, but it's true. And when I first began researching Penobscot history, for example, there were tidbits here and there, and the publications were few and far between. And I think when the state of Maine chose to implement the Maine Indian History and Culture Law, I believe it was in 2005, 2006, oftentimes referred to at that time as LD 291. When they began to implement that, I was working for Penobscot Nation, but I was on the advisory committee for the Cultural and Historic Preservation Department, and we realized that there was a shortage of information, and where we were expecting teachers to teach about Maine Indian history and culture, all of a sudden, like, it was going to be required by law, that they didn't have the resources really or adequate resources to do that. And so from that point on, things really kind of took off in terms of what was available for the resources. But when I first began, it was, I have a whole collection of just little tidbits of information still yet to be put together in some useful form. But just to have everything all in one place, I think, is so important for future researchers. I'm really proud of the work that Wabanaki Reach did to be sure to archive their work and the ways that, it will add to the overall contribution of academia, scholarship around these topics, probably in ways that we don't even know yet. Down the road, somebody can, come up with a new topic idea and find information in these files. And so it's so important to have these large collections, all together in one place. I'm really happy to hear that's happening. And also very impressed when you talked earlier, Kat, about the MOU and not taking ownership of the collection. So the ownership can remain with the tribal voices. I think that is, so important and so hopefully precedent setting.
And I actually do have a follow-up question with the MOU. Now, again, like when you think of MOUs, it's still sort of like logically this idea that, is really set in time. Is there components of the MOU that's more of like a living agreement where changes can be made between Reach and the institution or even the individuals who shared that information or their stories there? Do they retain any agency in, whether they want to have their stories removed or have them be anonymous? Do you mind sharing more about that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the reasons why MOU just felt like so much more comfortable and accurate in terms of reflecting the type of relationship we wanted to have. While we have a deed for the TRC, we treat it more as a relationship. And so we absolutely take the lead from Reach and from the statement providers about what their comfort level is. And so we have over the years received requests to have statements taken down. As I mentioned, Reach did an amazing job educating statement providers about what was going to happen. Not only that their statement would be made available, but that it would be made available online. But saying that and living that as a statement provider are two different things. And so we have had over time requests for statement providers to have their statements removed or anonymized. And we absolutely honor that. So while we administer the TRC collection, I don't feel like we own that. And so thinking about how we wanted to codify this relationship, and again, an MOU is sort of more reflective of that. In the case of the specific one we have with Reach, we actually articulated within the MOU that we would be deferring to them around questions of whether or not they would want materials removed or added. And we also articulated that they would be the ones that would administer rights for the collection, so that if somebody wanted to create another book and publish excerpts, it would be Reach that would be involved in determining if that was something that they wanted to have done or not have done. We also set a 10-year period of time so that we could just revisit it. I mean, documents are, they should be thought of, I think, as living documents. The technology we have, the people involved, they're going to change so much over 10 years. And so to revisit it, I think, is a really good idea. And again, this was new, new for both of us. Built into here the idea that if we decide it's not working, either party can say, like, yeah, it was a good idea. Didn't quite work the way we wanted it to. And because this is an all digital collection, physically, there's nothing that we would be returning, but we have made clear commitments in terms of how we would remove materials from our digital archive. Does that get at what your question was, Nolan?
Yes, it does. Just kind of solidifying that. Whereas these moments are tied to specific moments in time, things change, just like you said, and having an agreement and relationship that reflects that change. So thank you.
Okay, we're getting close to the end of our program here, so I'm gonna finish with one last question for both of you. When do these archives open, and how are either of you hoping the public interacts with the archived information?
Shall I go first, Maria, and then you can follow? Because you have you I feel like you should get the last word here, since your involvement goes back to the very beginning of the project. The official opening is going to be on April 22nd, which is, I believe, a Wednesday, at 4:30 p.m. here at Bowdoin. And Maria will be speaking, I know, that day. And then we expect that we'll have some other participants as well, both a statement provider and a statement collector. We are having some preliminary conversations now with faculty who teach in areas related to Indigenous studies and environmental studies. And at present, the thought is that they might want to offer a teach-in to Bowdoin students preliminary to the event, so that Bowdoin students who might attend that day would get a better understanding of the history of the Maine Indian land claims settlements, and be able to fully engage with the conversation. We're also thinking of that as sort of phase one of an opening, I will say. We're hopeful that we can also have a book launch of some sort. So we hope to have copies of the book available for people. It's for those of you who have not seen it, it's an incredible book. It's so beautiful. There's excerpts from the stories paired with Nolan's photography as well as Maya's photography, and the images are truly stunning and are so evocative. It really helps make sense of the stories that are in the book. I think to see the land and the rivers and the places being spoken about. So we'd love to have some of those photographs here at some point as well. So we're hoping for a series of events over time.
So it is true. I'm going to break my hibernation and come to the archive opening in April. I'm really happy for the invitation to be part of the program. I always say that Beyond the Claims was my baby while I was executive director for Wabanaki Reach, and I really appreciate the ability for Wabanaki Reach to continue to engage in these difficult conversations that are so necessary to have. Just because you ignore them, they don't go away. But also creating new resources for our tribal members to engage in, for scholars to engage in. I just see a lot of value in making that available. And I don't know about ways to engage younger students in it. I guess the field of education isn't really my forte, so I'm not even sure what the age ranges would be, but I'm sure like there's something in there for everybody, and hearing people, and I love that you can hear them as well. I mean, just hearing the voices of our loved ones, and especially many who have passed on since we started the Beyond the Claims project. That's going to be such a treasure in and of itself to hear those voices. But a lot of good things I hope will come from it. And everything is built on top of something else, so it's kind of standing on the shoulders of all these other historians and activists and archivists and all of that. So we continue to build and we continue to grow and grow in understanding the relationship between within our tribal community and also with our tribal community and the outside community. We continue to grow and to learn.
Yeah, the archive's really going to bring folks together in a good way, and I think that's a perfect place to end our time here together. And I just want to thank you both, Maria and Kat, for taking the time to reflect and share on this process of collaborating with each other. Thank you to the listeners for joining us on Dawnland Signals. Thank you to volunteer technician Scarlett Tudor for her assistance and support. Be sure to join us next month in every first Tuesday of the month for Dawnland Signals and more conversations of truth, healing, and change. Abjij Gnomiopa.
Minach Kanamio.